So, my friends, I wanted to share a little bit about taking refuge in the Triple Gem. And actually, this is going to sound funny, but this kind of surprised me because I wasn't really thinking of doing anything about this. And actually, I was thinking of canceling. But this kept popping in my head, and I finally yielded because it's an amazing area and something that I find super helpful in times when the well runs dry or when I'm feeling battered. And as many of you know, the taking refuge in the Triple Gem of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or the three jewels, is traditionally the threshold for becoming a practicing Buddhist. That's if you take refuge, then you're a Buddhist, quote unquote. And so this is universal across all traditions, certainly held differently to whatever degree it's ceremonial or not, but it's embedded anyway in all tradition, and it's a kind of a common ground to connect different traditions. I remember when I took refuge, I think it was 1987, at a weekend retreat at Cloud Mountain with Venerable Genla Rinpo, who was an amazing Tibetan Lama who was one of my very first teachers. And it was a whole weekend thing. It was a really beautiful series of teachings. And it was a Mist Haven, which, by the way, back then was the only retreat building. This was before Diamond Hall was built and back when Cloud Mountain had no electricity. So it had a real evocative sort of feel to the whole thing. But what's useful and powerful about the three jewels is how they can support us on the path and how they can help restart us and get us pointed in the right direction, which means the direction that connects with our reality. And especially when, you know, when times are tough or when we feel kind of isolated or without direction or we're just sucking air, these three can be a great boon in knowing where to go, where to turn ourselves. And as a way, to me, kind of almost the essence of this is how we can merge our minds with the energy essence of the three jewels to connect our hearts and minds with what they are and the way that gives us guidance. They're kind of like it can be a North Star to know where we're pointing, and I'll kind of break that out. And I love this Tibetan Buddhist version I shared with you because it expands slightly from the more sparse Theravada approach, kind of builds on it. So this is, you know, this is Sutrayana. It's not Vajrayana practice, which involves yidams and stuff, but it's Sutrayana practice within Mahayana, greater vehicle. And I'll read it. It says, I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Through the merit I create by practicing giving and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. And a lot of some slightly different approaches baked into this than you'd see in Theravada world. It transposes without any problems and in some ways is helpful. So I just want to go through it line by line. And when it says, I take refuge until I am enlightened, I mean, I think that's so powerful because what's powerful about this is where it points us to being enlightened, which is what the Buddha constantly talks about in the suttas. He didn't talk about getting mellow, being relaxed a little bit once in a while, but he always talks about being enlightened. That's what he's pointing to. So we're not just taking refuge to be safe. We're taking refuge until I am enlightened to be enlightened. So it's just this powerful sense of direction. And again, the Buddha always repeatedly said that's why he says, I'll teach suffering and the end of suffering, which is a code for enlightenment. And then in other ways, in other suttas, he expresses it in very direct ways that's what he's doing. And, you know, to be sure, in the path, we have all kinds of awakenings and openings of wisdom and perspective and view and compassion as part of our growth, but still to keep the beacon of enlightenment out front is really helpful and helps us from getting sidetracked or stuck or thinking that some, you know, degree we've grown, which is wonderful, But to think that to sort of let ourselves get lulled into sitting there versus keeping moving would not be so helpful. But so that's why this is so helpful. And it can be hard to keep track of where we're going sometimes, you know, especially here in 2022 in the West, in the middle of a zillion diversions. I mean, if we were in a monastery in Tibet in the 9th century, it'd be pretty straightforward. Pretty much we wouldn't have any choice. But here, we got all kinds of choices. And, you know, part of the paradox is we're not, at least speaking for myself, I'm not enlightened yet. So how am I supposed to know where it is I'm trying to head when I don't know what it is yet? So to try to balance between those and to focus on what we're aspiring to, even though we don't quite know what it is yet. So that's, you know, it's part of the puzzle, and that's okay. But that's why this setting of intention right at the beginning of this taking refuge is really beautiful. And so in terms of taking refuge, you know, why would we do that? I mean, this funny little sort of set of lines I just uttered, if from a sort of skeptical 21st century point of view, it can seem like a little bit of superstitious hocus pocus to kind of recite these things over and over, and what's that all about? But when we restate it that we're taking refuge until we're enlightened, then this really clarifies what it is, and it kind of strips away all the trappings, like what's the essence? What's the essence of what Buddha taught, and what's the essence of what people have recognized also, you know, over this 2600 years, if not before. So it really brings in mind the essence of this. And what is refuge? You know, what does refuge mean here? I mean, it can mean a lot of things, but to me, it's a combination of a sense of direction, like I've been talking about, and also sort of a warm protection, you know, like a, kind of a safety, kind of a warmth, a nurturing support. And then also a resonance with enlightened mind. That's another really important aspect of it, like a inner connection with awakened mind. And that's a kind of a flavor that isn't so, I don't know, obvious in early Buddhism, but it's really strong in Zen and Tibetan. There's a whole idea of transmission, you know, the transmission of a mind from awakened person to a student. And it's a tangible thing. And, you know, you kind of look at the way people speak about being around Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Buddhadasa, people like that, or Ajahn Mun, and how they had so much presence. And somehow just that proximity, just being aware of who they were, moved them along. So it's this taking refuge is a lot about that, about this sense of connection, resonance that keeps us going. And this is sort of an ultimate kind of direction then. We're talking about awakening, and, you know, it's not our immediate experience right now, maybe hints and tastes, but it still seems far off. It's not exactly the right word, but we know how enormous, we have some visceral sense of how enormous awakening is. And, you know, again, speaking for myself here, I'm muddling along in the 22nd century, you know, with a funny voice. And so it can seem really far away. But in a way, that ultimate aspect is really a benefit, because it's a constancy. And no matter what our situation, you know, it might be today we're sick, tomorrow our spouse is mad at us, you know, the next day we're remembering some sorrowful moment, whatever those conditions, or there's a natural disaster. There's a consistency that can overarches all that. So it's really helpful just to keep our oars in the water, in an ultimate sense, in the middle of conditionality. So the heart of the matter is what we take refuge in, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So let's take a little look at what that might mean for us. And you notice in this version I read to you, it doesn't say Buddha, it says Buddhas with an S, as in plural. And that's really interesting. To me, that's relevant for several reasons. And, you know, in the suttas, I mean, Buddha is always talking about, and it comes up frequently, his prior Buddhas. And prior Buddhas when he wasn't a Buddha, but they were Buddhas. So there's a sense that Shakyamuni Buddha in 2600 years ago, he wasn't the only Buddha. There was others before him, not to mention all the arhants. So I think what's useful about it, thinking of it in terms of Buddhas, is that it depersonalizes this whole thing. And to whatever degree we might think, oh, the Buddha's different from us. He's some kind of special charismatic person. I'm not that. Forget it. That ain't me. If there's many of them, then it opens the attitudinal shift to realize, yeah, we can do that too. Because these multiple people did it. And so it's helpful in that way. It broadens it. But of course, then there's also the Buddha. We can think of it that way in terms of the historical Shakyamuni Buddha. So I'm saying that wrong. Just because we have this incredible access through the suttas to see what he said, what he taught, and the situations in India. And actually you can see the textures and tastes of it all and really take refuge in that sense of a person who is so unstoppable and dedicated and sort of combination of sort of ferocious and incredibly loving at once. So there's that really extraordinary aspect. But this is also an opportunity to turn, and this is where I find it really useful, to turn inwardly toward the awakened mind of a Buddha and take refuge in that. It's almost like it's a practice right there to just, in your heart, just go deeper and whatever it is for you right now, your best sense of that. Because we feel like we're mundane, we're just stuck in our monkey minds and all that, but to just turn toward what a Buddha is and take refuge in that inwardly, that can really just reorient us when we're off the rails a little bit or just stuck in mundane stuff, which is so easy to do. You know, if we go on and on, then our life is over. So maybe it's good to keep, you know, reorienting ourselves to this ultimate direction that the Buddha embodied and realized. And this turning, so tuning to the mind of the Buddha is also attuning to the essence of our own mind. There's no difference. It's just, we're Buddhas, just we're obscured. You know, it's just our kleshas, our conditioning, our karmas are all in the way, but we're just like the Buddha. So if we can keep turning to that, and the essence, we can see it better. And the dross kind of, it's like clarifying butter kind of moves away a little bit over and over and over. So it's an important process. I often envision this refuge in the Buddha kind of like a lighthouse or a beacon. It illuminates our way forward. It shines in our dark places. It helps us see when we can't see. So it's just sometimes when things are really hard sometimes, and I can just take refuge. I'll just take refuge like right there in the middle of dark street in New York or something, you know, and just go, oh yeah, okay. Reset, and then continue. And it's so simple. Three words, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So the second of the jewels is refuge in the Dharma, which in a different way, it helps us find and keep our sense of direction. And again, there's sort of several levels. And one is the Dharma is simply the Buddha's teaching, what the Buddha taught, how to awaken. Everything he taught was how to awaken. It all kind of comes at it from a billion different angles and with all kinds of metaphors about farming and telling elephants what to do and everything else. But it's all about how to awaken. And we're so fortunate in this situation, in this tradition here in 2022 that, I mean, I can't speak for other traditions because I don't know so much, but that we really have access to what he said. The suttas are amazing, you know? I mean, I know there's debate about how much of it really came forward and all that, but when you really read them closely, they're just incredibly coherent. There's not like, oh, this contradicts that kind of stuff. It's not. The whole thing is unbelievably coherent. And as we practice and grow, it's like levels reveal themselves. You know, it's like, oh, I didn't notice that last time through. So we're really fortunate to have the Dharma in that way where it's beautiful and it works in the Pali Canon, in the Four Nikayas in particular. So the words of the Buddha are really a refuge. And this gets a little more complex in Mahayana traditions, which some of you may know is the greater vehicle. So, that's just what they call themselves. So you can think what you want, but it's pretty much what happened in Northern Asia, Tibet, China, Japan, Korea, as the Dharma moved across Northern Asia. And to some degree, not so connected with the historical Buddha as we are in early Buddhism across Sri Lanka, Thailand, Myanmar, and Cambodia. Just as an aside, and I won't name a name, but there's a Tibetan teacher I knew pretty well, and I was once in this person's office, and they had a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya that was shrink-wrapped. And I said, yo, have you actually ever opened that? And the person said, well, actually, I haven't yet, but I will. So, and it's fine. But the point being that for people in Mahayana tradition, they much more refer to what their great masters, and there were great masters, what their great masters said, and the incredible prolificness of, say, Tibetan teachers. I mean, it's unbelievable what they cranked out. Milarepa and Longchenpa and all these great, great voices. I don't know Zen so well, but so this question of what the Dharma is and if it relates to the Buddha, it's a little more complex in Mahayana tradition. But it's in a way, it's good to have that in mind, in the back of our minds a little bit, because it really is the Dharma. It's got a different form, but it's just extraordinary. And it is a Dharma. And so we can kind of, it almost, because the form is different, it helps us look, turn toward the essence. It's like, oh, wait a minute, that's jangling to me. That's not the way I used to it. But then, okay, look deeper. See where is this tradition coming from that has, you know, led to people's awakening for centuries and centuries. So in a way, there's a beauty to that, even if we're mostly in early Buddhism, to kind of be cognizant of those other manifestations of the Dharma. So it kind of helps in a funny kind of way. It helps us not be stuck in form and to look toward the essence of what is in the suttas when we look at it that way. And there's another way in terms of what the Dharma means. It's just simply the way. I mean, the one way, it's the teachings of the Buddha. Another way, it's just simply the way things are. And in this sense, we're taking refuge in truth, in reality, in just what we see when we're clunk up against reality. And that's part of, you know, how this practice works. I mean, everyone's got a slightly different version of what it is you see when you are aware and you clunk up against whatever emerges, and that is your unpacking. But it has to do with being clear, getting clearer, and bumping up against reality, and then slowly, slowly emerging in that and unpacking it and letting go and not being stuck. So to really think of that as Dharma, you know, aligned with what the Buddha taught, and kind of let those two be in close formation and see how they interrelate in your heart and mind, is really useful. And it really helps us have confidence in our own awakening, in our own vision, in our own unpacking as we practice. And the funny thing is that, I mean, I just speak from my own experience, and you may or may not agree, I don't know, but my own experience is that what the Buddha taught and what I see in reality, they completely correspond. They just there's no conflicts. They just completely correspond and help affirm each other. So, because if he himself said, don't, you know, in the famous suttas with the Kalamas, he said, don't follow someone because of what he, you know, what he said, what was written in books, what other people said he's good at, what hearsay, all that kind of stuff. Practice and see what you see. So that's why the Dharma is such a great place of refuge, second jewel. And then the third, Sangha, is incredibly precious because it's the human manifestation of all that, of all this, as in people, as in all of us. But it, because it's part of this three jewels, it's humans drenched or pervaded by the mind of the Buddha and the Dharma. So it kind of makes us look at it differently than, you know, our normal this person, that person, about whom I have judgments or attractions or revulsions or anything. It doesn't matter. It's really about the Dharma in terms of these people. So traditionally, Sangha referred to people in robes, i.e. monastics. And this is a great place to start. And I think it's really a great place to stay attuned to. Forgive me, someone's knocking in the door. And our Chihuahua is helping us not be taken out by whoever is knocking at the door. Oh, what should I do? And Ellen probably can't hear them from upstairs. Can I put you on hold? This is so bizarre. No, here she comes. Hang on a second. I'll mute you. Ah. Suburban Dharma. All right. But people in robes. I mean, for me personally, I've just really been appreciating the value of monastics more and more, just because they're, and especially in our tradition, because their actions, their intentions, their ethics are all so defined by their monastic vows, by the Vinaya. And as some of you know, Clear Mountain Monastery is starting up here in the Seattle area. So I've been around Tanisabo quite a bit. And, you know, really sort of gotten my heart more around what the realities of those vows are. You know, not handling money, only take food that's offered, can't keep food overnight, can't ask for anything except for water. Right there. Isn't that amazing? So, yeah, not to mention, you know, not owning anything except for the requisites, which is a bowl, three ropes, an umbrella, a toothbrush, shoes. I think that's it. So to really value that tradition, and it's growing in the West, is so great. And not, you know, the great, the amazing emergence, finally, of bhikkhunis, fully ordained bhikkhunis at Aloka Vihara, Karuna Vihara here in on our West Coast, cutting edge coolness. So that's so important, kind of balancing out the gender thing. So to orient towards those and connect with those in our hearts in terms of our inner compass is just so important. And, you know, for me, how do I say, because I've been around a long time and been in, so the spiritual journey has been complicated. But one thing I've noticed is that there's sometimes lay teachers who can seem really charismatic and have a lot of insight, and they mess up. And it's ethically. They mess up ethically. It's happened time and time again. Of, you know, over decades and decades, I watched it, sadly. And not just with Westerners, the Asians over here have messed up too. So to be a monastic and really have the Vinaya nailed, and if you don't do it, then you're not a monastic anymore. It's like there's a real gatekeeper thing there. So I think the Sangha is really important, because we can really open our hearts and have some confidence. And we need that confidence to really harness the power of the three jewels to help us turn in the right direction, in the forward direction. So there's a way we can really trust, which is hard to do in 2022, this trusting thing. But the monastics really embody kind of the essence of what the Buddha taught. And there's monastics these days living on the West Coast that are living in such a way that the Buddha, you know, if the Buddha was here and this was his Sangha of 500 bhikkhus, they'd fit right in. And they wouldn't be doing any weird, different 21st century stuff. It wouldn't be any different. They'd fit right in. It's pretty cool. So we can really touch on that. And in a broader sense, Sangha also refers to all of us. It's like the second layer, you know, this broad sphere of lay practitioners who are so cool and are really doing their best to bring to life what the Buddha taught. And this is wonderful in a different way, you know, because we all, everyone here has glimmers of awakening. Everyone here shares these seeings here and there. It's all real. It's all good. And we can turn toward each other and honor each other and learn from each other and hear from each other. And so that's also really important. And, you know, I know people here are friends in different ways and have formed different kinds of bonds and things. And plus just this kind of Sangha bond we have here. So that's so important, because, you know, it's a pretty materialistic world out there. And you know, I sort of want to be careful, because I do a lot of interreligious stuff. So I got to say, my heart has broadened about the amazing depth of people from all different traditions. Just from working with, I'm on the steering committee of the fostering interreligious relations on the east side. So I've gotten really tight with a couple of Mormons, Zoroastrians, some Muslim folks, all kind of folks. And they're great. They're great. So I don't want to judge anybody. But just in terms of our world out there, you know, it's pretty samsaric. So we are this collective, any kind of collective like this, is really important to keep when we're confused. Just like, almost like remember. I do that sometimes. Just remember this circle. That, oh yeah, that's it. You know, and find footing again. And I guess I'll say, you know, you all know I'm editor of Northwest Dharma News, or have this role editing. I don't label myself editing Northwest Dharma News, but I have contact with all these leaders and teachers around the area. And with this issue coming together right now, I've just once again been struck by the depth of people in our tradition, Buddhist tradition, whatever their Mahayana or different kind of aspects are, and how deep that is. So it's a real, urge you to read Northwest Dharma News for no other reason than to help deepen the sense of Sangha, because you can really feel just the vibrancy and depth and different kinds of expression of authenticity and kindness. And also wisdom, not sticky, that is there. So all these things are important. All these things are important. So that's the essence of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And some thoughts about how we can use those to illuminate the path ahead. And then just in closing, this version that we're talking about of the taking refuge, is it expands our intentions, which is something that Mahayana is really good about. It takes them outward from just our own awakening to benefiting sentient beings. And as you likely know, this refers to the Bodhisattva ideal, something that some IMS teachers work with pretty, Joseph Goldstein does, Guy Armstrong does, pretty pointedly. And there may be others that I don't know about. But it is something that's sort of, it's Mahayana, but it's interpenetrated, the sort of least IMS-y interpretation of early Buddhism, not so much in Theravada per se, although it's an arguable point because there's a lot of sense of that in the Sangha. Anyway, so just read these last two sentences and then say a few more things and then I'll stop and I'm sure you'll be all relieved. It says, through the merit I create by practicing giving and other perfections, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. I just think this is so important. Because the first sentence is like, look at the simplicity of that. Through the merit I create by practicing giving and other perfections. And is linking the simple choices we make in life to this utterly profound question of Buddhahood. It's like lacing them together. You cannot separate them. And even, the six perfections, even if they're imperfect, even if they're incremental, they keep moving us toward recognizing the nature of mind. And by the way, the six are generosity, dana, as this thing referred to. And then in terms of the six perfections, which is a Mahayana slightly, but anyway, it's ethics, sila, energy, virya, concentration, and wisdom. So that's the six perfections from a slightly Mahayana point of view. But it just mentions generosity here. And I kind of love that because, well, we can all do that. I don't know if we can do concentration or wisdom. Maybe that's kind of a heavy lift right now, or we're kind of halfway there. But generosity, we can keep doing that, Just give someone a little extra, whatever we do, whatever it is, be kind to someone, all that little generosity stuff. And look what happens to our minds, how it kind of clears and lifts a little bit. It's a little less self-sticky. And I think what is important about that phrase, that sentence, merit I create, is that it makes it real clear that those little things we do are in fact essential parts of the path. And it's moving us in that direction.
Steve does.
And then generosity leads to Buddha. And then the last sentence, and it takes this important turn of towards bodhicitta, awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. And it says, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. Very much a Mahayana point of view, that the reason for awakening is the awakening of all sentient beings. And the Buddha kind of talks like that, actually. There's lots of references to helping others awaken and compassion towards all beings and all kinds of stuff like that in the suttas. So it's not black and white at all, but it is really brought up in Mahayana. I'm most aware of Tibetan tradition. It's really brought up. It's beautiful. Can't get around it. So this helps with taking refuge because it clarifies that we're doing it for our own awakening and also for all sentient beings. And we're interconnected in harmony with all beings. There's, you know, it's not like we're separate. It's not like we're on this little triple by ourselves, but we can't really separate that. So to kind of turn our hearts outwards, you know, for whatever it's worth, in Mahayana tradition, they say you can't fully awaken unless you fully perfect bodhicitta, because it takes you away from your self-cherishing. So this whole thing, you know, this whole journey has been about resonance, about reflecting our potential to awaken. And it's an infinite task that speaks to our infinite nature. Let's just sit for a moment.